Welcome to Wine About History. Today we have Samuel Fort, the author of The Cult of the Great Eleven. He spent 10 years in the military, serving as a linguist, cryptographer, and intelligence analyst. After leaving the service and graduating college, he worked as a private investigator and researcher, and took a job as an overseas operations manager in the Middle East, Southwest Asia, and Far East. He has a passion for reading and writing. His favorite genres being history, true crime, and unsolved mysteries. Sam is also the author of two science fiction fantasy books, The Apocalypse Script and The Arduino Key. Thank you for your service. And today we're talking about his very good book, The Cult.
Well, normally at this point in the Wine About History podcast, we talk about the wine that we're drinking. But today, since this book takes a tradition, we're not drinking wine, we're just having water.
Well, alcohol might have been more appropriate.
Or I was thinking, you know, I'm picturing parties in the 20s with the champagne flowing, even though technically it was illegal. And a little part of me was thinking, maybe we could have a little sparkling wine today, but we'll just have water.
Okay.
But anyway, well, thanks again for joining us, Sam. And this book is super fascinating. And we're just going to get right into it and ask, what made you want to write this novel?
Well, I tell you, I've written a novel before called The Apocalypse Script, which is just a work of fiction. But I'm a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft, like a lot of people are today. And I was always wondering when I read his books, because so many of his books involve cult activity, or the Cthulhu cult, or well, there's any number of them. And I started wondering, why? What is his inspiration? Why were there so many cults in his stories? And he was an author that was popular in the 1920s and 30s. So I thought, well, maybe this is the way it was. Maybe there were a lot of weird cults back in the 20s and 30s that he was drawing inspiration from. So I like doing a lot of research, and I started looking into it. I started looking into the cults of the 1920s and 30s. And in the process of doing that, I ran across dozens, hundreds of cults, I guess. But this one really caught my eye because of its weirdness. So I spent about 6 years, 7 years maybe, collecting data on it. And finally, I thought, well, this is just too weird and too unknown. I've got to capture this in a book and share it with the world somehow.
Why do you think the behavior of this cult, was so much odder than other cults in the time?
I think because of who founded it, Mae Blackburn. You know, originally she wanted to be a movie producer. That was her big dream, and she wanted her daughter Ruth to be like the lead actress in all her movies. And that was their initial plan. They went to Portland and tried it. They made the first motion picture in Portland. It flopped. So they went to Los Angeles, tried again, and when it flopped again, that's when they started their cult activity. And I think it's so weird because a lot of cults in that era, and I guess even today, are really based on some form of some modification of Christianity where it's somewhat acceptable. I mean, there's some New Age stuff also, but May's cult was interesting in that she drew members in saying that she talked to angels and she was taking dictation from God, and it was all based on the book of Revelation. But once you were actually in the cult, things got a lot weirder. They actually had things like mystical mansions on Olive Hill and hidden gold and jewels. They practiced sacrifice of animals. They may, I think probably, sacrificed humans. They just had a very esoteric, I would say even pagan set of beliefs, which were pretty unique in the time.
Right. Well, you talked about how she read the Bible, and I'm thinking she's reading the Bible, maybe not for a religious person to get closer to God, maybe, but to figure out how she could make a cult. At least that was my interpretation of it.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, one of her earlier husbands after the divorce said, you know, neither she nor Ruth really seemed to have any interest in religion. So I think to her, like I said, the failed movie maker who still wanted to be an actress, or still wanted her daughter to be an actress, rather, she was using the Bible as source material, and the cult was, in a way, theater. Now, for her, it was very profitable theater, and for her victims, it was very dark theater. But in a way, that's what it was, and that's why it got so fantastic. I think the Bible is just the thin veneer that they put on top of all this.
What do you think happened to when the members are disappeared? Because I remember you talking about Sammy Rizzo. Were they exiled? Were they killed?
Yeah, so Sammy Rizzo is probably the most famous. I think he was probably killed. He never popped back up. I went through a lot of newspapers. And actually, about a year ago, I was contacted by some of his descendants, his great-nephew, who said that, they had no idea whatever happened to Sammy. So he never reemerged. And he actually learned a lot from the book. He was very appreciative, and it was really nice talking to him. They didn't even have any pictures of Sammy, except for the ones that they found in the book. So he never resurfaced. Now, there's always the question, they did have some supposed mafia involvement. Could he have run off and got killed? It's possible. But could he have run off and left his mom and his brothers and his sisters, who he was very close with, and never even wrote them a letter? That seems very unlikely. So I think he was disposed of. And he might be in a box at Bear Lake, which was one of the other chapters of the Great 11. Of course, Willa Rhodes, she was another victim of the cult. She didn't disappear. She died, but died under very mysterious circumstances. And a lot of the members who were supposedly in the cult were never tracked down. So there's definitely some nefarious activity going on. It's hard to say who of the victims were actually victims of May and who just disappeared of their own volition.
Your dedication of the book is to Willa.
Yes.
And why Willa?
Well, Willa was the ultimate real victim of the cult. I mean, Willa Rhodes is the pivotal character. She was, the adopted daughter of Martha and William Rhodes in Klamath County, Oregon. And when she was around 14, her mother and father became members of the Great 11. Now, it seems like they also had some sort of unusual activity going on that her mom was orchestrating in Oregon. But when she found May, I think she found a peer. And so she joined the Great 11. She brought her daughter down to Los Angeles. She was about 14 at the time. And no more than about a month and a half after she arrived in Los Angeles, she was set up in this crazy house, which was basically the Cult of the 11's dormitory. And she was made a queen. And basically all the other cultists who were there treated her like a queen. Now, this is a 14-year-old girl. But soon after, she got an infected tooth, or at least this is a story that police were told, 5 years later. She got stuck in a bed. She was not allowed medical treatment because the cult didn't believe in medical treatment, or at least her mother didn't. And on New Year's Day, she died. Well, you'd think that might be the end of the story, and there's a good reason to question whether that death was natural or not. She did have an ulcerated tooth. But it happened on New Year's Day, which is very symbolic. So what they did, May decided that this girl was to be proof of the resurrection she was promising. So they didn't report the death. They snuck her out, took her to another house, set her up in a room, and laid her on a block of ice and put roses around her, which they changed every day. And oh, by the way, she was also given 7 dogs before she died as a gift, and those dogs were ceremonially murdered when she died. So they took Willa and these 7 dogs, put them all on ice, the dogs around her, put her in this room, brought roses into it every day, waiting for her just to snap back to life. When that didn't happen, they moved her to another house, and they basically put her coffin and the 7 dogs in this shantily built addition to the house. Now, not many people in the cult, I think more people than said they knew, but most of the cult didn't actually know she died. They thought she'd gone off to a boarding school somewhere. After that, they moved her to another house, which the cult bought for Martha and William. And they went to the parents' bedroom, removed the flooring, dug a special, basically, tomb for Willa and these dogs. And it was specially made so that the lid could be removed so that when Willa came back to life, and at this point she's actually mummified. Her mother had some secret ritual ingredients that she went to a drugstore and bought, and she basically treated the dogs and Willa so that they would maintain a, sort of like they did with, I think it was Lenin in the Soviet Union, basically they would still look like they were sleeping. So anyway, they buried her beneath the floorboards of the parents' room, and every night, this is the creepiest part, I still can't get over this, every night basically her parents were sleeping about 3 feet above their daughter's corpse and the corpse of these 7 puppies, with the thought that at some point in the middle of the night there was going to be a knock on the bottom of the floorboards that would be their daughter come back to life. So I think ultimately she was the, she was a real victim. I mean, you know, a 14-year-old girl, she may have had some beliefs, but at that age, you know, it's hard to say. She wasn't mature enough to know what she was doing. So I think her death and the treatment of her body afterwards was, it was obviously criminal. It was also tragic. And so I thought that was proper that she at least be acknowledged in the book.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I think that death got to us more than the other things that we read.
When I first started reading the book and I read about what happened to her, I had to stop for a little while to process how bad
the
death of a 14-year-old girl is, and then her treatment afterwards, insane. And her parents, May must have taken advantage of their grief. And although I remember in the book you said she did, May Otis liked the little girl, liked her a little bit.
She did. And, you know, May Otis, it's really hard to say what her beliefs and preferences and everything were, because we only have fragments of history, but there are several accounts of her attempting to either recruit or abduct children from the parents. Sometimes she would be so flagrant as just to go up to, and this happened in Simi Valley, she just went up to a mom and said, "Your daughter looks like an angel, can I have her? And I'll get her a lot of pretty dresses if you let me have her," which was obviously the mom said no. But she was terrified for the rest of her life that May was going to hunt her down and take her daughter. There was another instance where she stopped her big car next to a house and had her chauffeur get out. And he was approaching a child that was in the yard. Luckily, the parent showed up with a shotgun and ran him off. So she had a peculiar fascination with children. Yes.
What about this cult shocked you the most?
I think just the bizarreness of it. I mean, this was a very detailed theology. I mean, May told her followers she was dictating a book from angels. They came to her every night, her and Ruth, both, her daughter. And her daughter was quite beautiful. That was also a big draw for some of the cult members. She told her members she was dictating a book called The Great Sixth Seal, and that the angels Michael and Gabriel were coming to her every night in person and dictating these books and basically issuing concords. She said that they taught Ruth, the daughter, how to dance the ancient dances of Egypt. And part of the revelation was that there would be a new world coming. This was sort of the thing in the 1920s, Rowan, and she had her own believers about the apocalypse. But May's apocalypse was different, because when the apocalypse happened, she and 10 others, females from her cult, were going to become queens. And that's why we call this the cult of the Great 11. There are going to be 11 great queens. And they were going to rule the world. And they were going to get a mansion on top of Olive Hill, in California. And they were each going to get, I think it was 12 kings. And they were going to be surrounded with jewels and gold. And it's just, it went way over the top compared to what other cults were offering. I mean, she was not just a failed movie producer. She was very creative. She was a writer. And all that stuff is just so fantastic. We compare that and the other things she was doing, like sacrificing cars as part of her ritual, pulling up horses and pouring hot water over their backs as part of ritual. And by the way, the horses, died. It was just so crazy. It's just so insane. I don't think you could write fiction that could top this.
You're right.
Yeah.
And you said they sacrificed dogs, and that was very unusual. Mm-hmm. Most people didn't do that.
Right. And there was a long history of that. I think it was because, you know, back then, and if you ever watched movies, you know, silent movies from the 1920s, there were a lot of just dogs running around, right? The dog catchers and the dog trucks were always going out trying to capture, like, the dogs of the Little Rascals films. I think it was very easy because they wanted to do sacrifices to just round up dogs and do that. Now, there was never a dog sacrifice witness, but they did find the dog bones, and there were boxes delivered, which the police intercepted that contained dog bones. And that sort of ties into the belief that maybe May was going full pagan, and that she was, trying to. There was an ancient goddess, and I'm probably going to mess this name up. I think it's a Hecate or a Hecate, who was the goddess of portals and doors, and she was usually shown in iconography with dogs or horses. And it's hard to believe it was a coincidence that May was recruiting people with the name of Rhodes and calling them, giving them magical names like the Road to the Afterlife or wherever their concords were, sacrificing dogs, sacrificing horses. Just a lot of unusual correlations there.
Okay, that is really unusual. So I think we've covered what made the cult stand out. It was definitely its strangeness and how unique and how weird it was. But what do you think makes the cult so much more different? The blatant scheming and the robbing of its members, like the oil magnate gave her $40,000, the nephew of an oil magnate gave her $40,000, I think.
Right.
The strangeness. What do you think was makes it set, what's I'm looking for, makes it more unique?
Well, we've already talked about the weirdness. I don't think there's many cults then or now which could, say that they had mummified queens buried beneath their parents' bedroom or sacrifices or anything like that. But also the fact that it was, ultimately weirdly successful. May was brought to court on fraud charges and convicted, but that conviction was overturned because the... Dabney's people, it was Dabney who'd given her $40,000 who ultimately brought her to court on fraud. They introduced all the terrible things that had happened to Aquila and Sammy and everything, and that worked against him because they said that wasn't pertinent to the fraud charges. So the Supreme Court of California overthrew that. So the cult, May and her followers, got away with everything ultimately. They couldn't prove that Willa had been murdered. I mean, they acknowledged that she'd been badly treated, but they said, well, maybe she just died naturally. It's been 5 years. We can't really tell from her body. They have some very bizarre religious beliefs, but hey, who are we to say, how they want to treat their loved ones after they pass away? They couldn't prove Sammy Rizzio had died. They couldn't prove that Frances Turner, who was, I think anyone would fairly say baked in an oven as part of a ritual, and she died. Again, it was after the fact. She was already buried. They didn't really want to dig up the body. So everything they did that today would be sensational, I mean, every single element would probably be news forever, they got away with. And they went on, that the cult itself went on for at least, as a living organization for at least 10 or 15 years. And even Ruth was still putting out writings as late as the 70s, long after the cult itself had really dissolved. So I think this weirdness and its pertinence and how it just basically got away with everything.
Yeah, that's the part that kind of shocked me. I thought, for sure, this woman's going to serve some time.
Yeah.
They're going to lock her up and nope.
Throw away the key, and then she said, nope. And
it was the times, too, I suppose. They didn't have the technology back then that they do now. That might have been a different story.
Yeah, today, Willa Rhodes is like, you murdered this girl. You're going to jail.
Yeah, I think that's part of, if they've sort of dug up Willa's body today, I'm sure with modern forensics, they could have said, oh, yes, there's poison in this body, right? Or they probably could have tracked down Sammy Rizzio. There's any number of things they could have done today. But back then, it was kind of like, we've got a lot of stories. We've got a lot of loose information, a lot of people looking for missing victims. But we don't really have time for any of this. The Great Depression had just set in, too, of course. I mean, almost simultaneous with this. And there were just a lot of distractions, so they just let it go.
Sure. You talk about the time period that we did right after World War I, and how that might have been a little ripe for, I think you said, fertile ground for cults, especially in California. And do you want to talk about that a little more, like some of the social things that were going on?
Right, well, yeah, that was a big part of this. I mean, the reason there were so many cults, especially in the 1920s, and I read several sources on this that were contemporary. Several historians, doctors, physicians were talking about this. There were a lot of cults because the Great War just caused a lot of people to lose confidence in the old ways, right? I mean, prior to 1920, Western society is mostly Christian, and they always thought things were going to work out, that God was looking out for them, and that there could be bad things in the world, but they were explainable. I mean, it was still a Christian nation or a Christian civilization afterwards, but a lot of people had kind of lost faith. Their faith in God had been shaken by the atrocities and the great loss of life in the war. And, of course, spiritualism also popped up then. These were people who wanted to talk to those soldiers who had died. And, Houdini did a lot of investigations on stuff like that. But I think that was part of it. There were people who were looking for an alternative. It's like, well, we want to still be Christian, but we're looking for a reinterpretation of the Bible, a different, something that works out better, which can explain why all this terrible stuff happened. And there were a lot of charismatic, mostly con artists, cult leaders who were more than willing to take advantage of that, usually for financial gain.
Sure. And kind of happens today, too, I think.
Yeah.
I think that World War, you're right, that World War I really affected everyone deeply because art changes, everything in American culture changes around that time. So,
right, I mean, it's part of that lost generation, right, where everyone is just rethinking everything.
So another question, why do you think people believed in that? Like, people believe in cults for all sorts of different reasons, but this one had a following of over 100 people. Was it Booth's charms, or remember the cult had a little bit of, it had the orgies and had sex, and that may have been a big allure in the 1920s?
Well, yeah, I think ultimately it was because of May, and to some degree Ruth, her daughter. And it's hard to put to understand today, because what we know is that we've got some pictures of May, you know, and she was in her middle age, a very, normal looking woman. She wasn't, an extremely attractive woman. Ruth was. She was, she didn't look like anything. And she had this weird personality traits, like she wouldn't let anyone touch her. If you wanted to give something to May, you had to lay it down on the ground or somewhere and she would pick it up. So it wasn't any kind of external charisma or draw, but apparently she had just a way with words and these eyes, which many people called mesmerizing. Some very smart people. It wasn't just the poor. It was also some very educated and some very rich people just were prone to believe whatever she said. And it's really remarkable. If you think about some of the things that she was promising, you would think you would just, chuckle and walk away, but people didn't. When they heard these things, people believed her. So it's hard for us to capture just reading the newspaper articles and the history accounts of what happened, but she must have had that special thing that a lot of these cult leaders have, that special something, that magnetic kind of personality, which makes their believers believe anything that's said. You know, we were talking the Jim Jones or the Charles Manson, there's just that special personality trait, which is almost mystical, and it's really hard to pin down. But ultimately, I think that was why it was so effective. Also, it was because May promised was very good at theater, and she managed to make a much more colorful apocalypse, I think, than some of her contemporaries, where you just died and you got collected and went somewhere. She was going way over the top on that, and I think that drew a lot of people in.
Yeah, you hear that about cult leaders, mm-hmm. how charismatic they are, and they all seem to promise something. And they seem to promise something that people want desperately. And so I imagine she was the same.
A sense of purpose, normally. You see, when you see pictures and videos of Charlie Manson, you can see that you're talking about those mesmerizing eyes he has. And terrible.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. This was also something that people wanted, right? I mean, these were about, you know, probably half of her followers were downtrodden, not rich, and they probably believed, just like Clifford Dabney, who was not downtrodden, he was rich, but he wanted to be richer. May told them exactly what they wanted to hear, and that just made it that much easier.
Yeah.
Why do you think most people have never heard of the Blackburn Cult?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One, of course, is when it happened. You know, it was coming to trial, and all this was coming to the surface. So the cult had been around for about 10 years. This was like all over the newspapers, and then the Great Depression hit, and that hit home, right? I mean, the cult was entertainment for most of the country, but the Depression hit home, and people became far more concerned about their situation at home. But I think as a result of that, it was just never captured by history. I mean, it took me basically, you know, those 6 years of pulling information from all kinds of sources, census records, newspaper accounts, the USC archives, the Los Angeles Coroner's Office, friends and family, to pull all these loose strings together to make a coherent account of what actually happened. So I think it just hadn't happened until then. So you would see, prior to me publishing my book, little snippets on websites about, you know, these, maybe someone, Francis Turner boiled alive or Willa Rhodes mummified, but they were fragments. No one knew what the whole story was. So, you know, hopefully now, and that's one reason I wanted to write this book, it is part of history. And if someone wants to build upon it, that's great. And hopefully, you know, long after I'm gone, this will still be on shelves and someone can pull it off and say, oh, here's a history that would otherwise be forgotten.
Yeah.
So.
We're kind of running out of time here. So just before we go, we wanted to just ask you, is there anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to talk about regarding the book? Any final thoughts or anything?
No, I really appreciate your time. There's always possibilities that we'll get some wider distribution. I was very surprised, because this is sort of a cottage book. I mean, it's got a very specific audience who are interested in this kind of topic. I was contacted about a month ago by someone from Los Angeles asking if the rights were available for television or movies. So I have high hopes on that, you know, just like I have high hopes of winning the lottery someday. So we'll see. If anything happens, that'd be great. But no, just, you know, being able to share these stories and talk to folks like you about the story has been a reward enough. And I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about it.
Well, we appreciate your coming on. And we also appreciate your service as a military guy.
Thank you.
And again, just the name of the book, Cult of the Great 11 by Samuel Fort.
Yeah, and if you're a Lovecraft fan like me and Samuel, you will love this book. It really gives you an inspiration of the things he wrote.
Yeah, definitely. Tell your book groups about this book. I think it's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Pick up a copy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that'll do it
for
us here. And thank you again, Sam. And remember, if it weren't for history,
you wouldn't be here.
Thanks for listening,
everybody. Thank you.